This episode of the Citadel Cafe is brought to you by listeners like you. Visit patreon.com/thecitadelcafe to find out how you can become a patron and help make this show possible. This is the Citadel Cafe, episode number 362 for Friday, May 29th, 2020. My name is Joel Duggan, and the Citadel Cafe is where my friends and I hang out to talk about the geeky stuff that we're into. Joining me this week is Alistair McFly. You can find him at iMcFly on Twitter or /AlistairMcFly on Twitch. Welcome back to the show, my friend.
Hello, geeky stuff! Yay!
Yeah, yay! This is going to be a complete inside joke, but you and I are both Hermitcraft fans, and I feel like some of the shenanigans on that server are kind of bleeding over into the vernacular in my closed circle of friends, where it's just kind of like geeky stuff! Yay! It's the first thing my brain thought of when you said that. I was like, okay, yeah. No, I know.
Hermit challenges.
Hermit challenges. For people that don't know, Alistair and I play on the Citadel, which is the Minecraft server that I have going. Both of us stream from the server on Twitch, but we also watch a fair bit of Hermitcraft, which is, if your kids haven't told you about it already, Hermitcraft is a group of friends online that do YouTube videos, and they make Minecraft videos and post them on YouTube. And I watch more of that than I do traditional television now, because I find it far more entertaining and more accessible. So yeah, highly recommend. If you're looking for something fun and family-friendly to watch, you know, over being stuck at home the last little while, then Hermitcraft is definitely a place to go, because boy howdy do they have a lot of backlog. Like hundreds of episodes from tens of hermits. Like there's a lot of people doing stuff online, so there's no shortage of content. But dude, it's been a little while since I've had you on the show. What's been going on? It's last time you were on was the finale of Picard.
It was, wasn't it? Yes. Yeah. Everything's kind of starting to blur together because, you know, the situation we're in at the moment means that time suddenly has no meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Although that being said, because time has no meaning, getting to sleep has been challenging. But I have returned to work. I'm back in the office now. And I'm finding that being on my feet all day, my ankles are hurting a lot more than they ever have. My body's not built for it like it used to, but also I'm coming home exhausted, and I'm now getting to sleep okay now. It can be around midnight, you know, or maybe like 1-2, and it's just like I am sleeping. You know, it's timing me out, but that's to be a good thing.
I upped the workout regime. I've been pretty good. I mean, I was going to the gym before they all closed. And I've always been pretty good about working from home. I like going for a jog. Obviously, the excuse to get outside. It's now spring/summer already in Halifax, Dartmouth. So it's nice to be going outside and getting some fresh air. And if I can exhaust myself in the process, then at least I find that I can sleep better at night. Because I've had the same problem. I've had, you know, bad habits of like checking news and being up too late and too much screen time and all of that kind of adds up to like, well, I went to bed at 11, but I was up until 1, you know, and then I got up again the next day and, you know, at a regular time, because I'm still working. Like I've been working from home throughout the whole pandemic. Mm-hmm. But as you know, mentioned, like when you're at the office, you're on your feet. When I'm in the office, I'm on my butt. Like it's a lot of sitting and I take breaks. Yeah. Like, don't get me wrong. Like I, the wonderful freedom about working from home is being able to get up every 45 minutes for a glass of water or a stretch or just go stand on the balcony for 5 minutes, like whatever it is. I can do that, but it's still, you're not exactly tired at the end of the day. So I've been trying to increase the workout regime, and I've been stressed lately. There's just been a number of other factors outside of the normal world crap that's been going on. And I find that working out is a way to kind of just get those frustrations out. Like just, if you get yourself to the point where you're just too tired to worry, then you usually fall asleep a lot better. I unfortunately, and this is, I'm not sure how many people have experienced this, because I live in an apartment and the smoke detector in the apartment is wired. So it's not, there's a battery for backup, like if the power goes out, but when the power is on, it's powered by the building. Also the loudest smoke detector I have ever had. Like when I burn toast, the whole world knows it. However, when I feel like whenever there's a power fluctuation, it's kind of cool in that, like, if I lose power in a winter storm, when the power comes back on, the smoke detector will beep. Like, it'll just power back up and say, like, oh, I'm back on power, which is a great audio signal. Because in case you've gone around and turned everything off in the apartment, then when the power comes back on, you get, like, the smoke detector goes, like, boop, boop, and then says, hey, your power's back on. And so then you can go and, like, set the clocks and all that stuff. But the other night, and this was, I guess, overnight Monday into Tuesday, at 3 o'clock in the morning, and it wasn't even on the hour, it was at some random like 2:56 or something like that, my smoke detector went off. And I mean went off. Not low battery beeping, like not that little kind of like constant, like you should change the battery, that the old battery detector, the old battery operated ones that I used to know when I was in the house as a kid, when the battery would go low, it would just beep, like every 5 minutes, it would just kind of like go beep, beep, and just let you know, like, battery low, you need to change this. And it would just keep doing it.
This is full on, you need to evacuate now, kind of.
Yeah, yes. This is like, you're burning toast. And it's like, I'm in bed, asleep. Had gone to bed at like 11 or 12. So like, I am in the middle of sleep. And this thing goes off, and it's only, I don't know, 6 feet from my bedroom door. So like, I jumped out of my skin. Like, I was just, it went off. And I was awake and trying to figure out what was going on. And it's like, so you listen, and you're like, what, is that the fire alarm? And you only have enough time to process, like, yes, that is the fire alarm, and that is a full-on fire alarm, and it's mine, and then it stopped. And you're just like, oh, all right, is that, and then it went off again. But it was like seven or eight rounds of siren, and then it stopped. And it did that twice, and that was it. So then the loudest thing in my apartment is the heartbeat in my ears, because I'm like racing. Like, just, I mean, it's like, yeah, it's like being shaken awake. Like, it's if someone that, like, you're in your apartment alone and then all of a sudden someone is shaking your shoulders. Like, it's just so unnerving. Anyway, I laid there for another 90 minutes trying to get back to sleep. Couldn't. So 3 a.m. after 3 hours of sleep, I get up on Tuesday at 4:30 a.m. after like staring at the back of my eyelids for 90 minutes and had breakfast in the dark. and I was just thrown by it. And this whole week has been like a total shit show as far as sleeping is going. It's just been all over the map. And it's all started with that one thing and just snowballed from there, you know?
I'm just wondering how many expletives you've thrown at that fire alarm over the years that you've lived there for it to prank you like that.
I have no idea.
But it's kind of okay, we're going to get him up and then stop the moment he's up. It's funny. Like classic prank territory.
I was thinking about this the other day because, like, I don't swear much on the content that I create. The Citadel Cafe is an adult show. We don't curse a lot just because I just find it more fun not to. But, unless Megan is on the show, and then we're kind of like sailors.
It's hard to curtail Megan from that.
Yeah, I find it funny.
She'll be the first to admit that.
Yeah. No, I find it's also fun. It's also the appropriate show to do it on. I mean, like, for example, we can't talk about Game of Thrones and make it a kid friendly show. Like, this is not possible, you know. So, but it does, and it also means that if one of my guests or myself decide to swear, then I don't have to go back and edit it out because the explicit tag is on the podcast. It's fine.
Yes.
But it had me thinking, because somebody asked me the other day, like, do you curse? And it was in the Twitch chat. And I'm thinking, like, they're probably young. They want to make sure that, you know, they're watching something that they're allowed to watch. So, like, just, you know, they just ask in chat, like, you know, does he curse? And they're like, no, it's a family-friendly stream. And I kind of, like, had a little bit of fun with it. And I was like, well, I don't curse here. You know, like, no, I don't swear I'm family-friendly. I was like, well, I mean, I curse, just not here. Like, I'm an adult, you know? And I've noticed as over the last few months, as I've been calling friends, checking in, stuff like that, the language that we use has changed. when I'm calling, I'm old school, so I still tend not to swear very much around women. I know it's silly, but I do tend to be a little bit more polite. But when I'm talking with the boys, people that I've known for like 20 years, it gets vulgar. Like, and everybody's so stressed out with the pandemic and just like every other word. And then I was thinking about like, what's my favorite? Like, if I really get pissed off, like, what do I tend to swear? And I was talking with a friend about this and I had to think about it. But to my surprise, I drop a good Sam L. Jackson, like MF, right? That is my go-to.
Wow.
Yeah.
I don't think I've even heard you say
no,
that.
No, it's like, cause the question was, and even then, like even here now, when I'm talking about swearing on a show that I can swear on, I'm still not swearing. You know what I mean? Like it's one of those weird things where it feels weird for me unless it's incredibly appropriate. And I'm talking about like, you get up to get a glass of water in the middle of the night and you don't turn the light and you stub your toe. And like, and the first thing that comes out of my mouth, that's it. You know, when something really bad goes wrong, like when you spill dinner, you just, you know, spent 20 minutes making dinner and then like the pot tips over or you drop a bunch of stuff on the floor. Like, I mean, those are the words that comes out of my mouth. Like it's so, and it's not something I think about, but it's like, wow, like I go straight there. it's really interesting when you actually think about it, you know?
Yeah, when I think about, like, if I stub my toe, I think that my reaction is going to be one of two things. It's either dropping an F-bomb, or it's going for a very British bloody hell, as one of the two likely responses.
Yeah, and I've picked up some stuff.
The times when I do that.
I've picked up some stuff from hanging out with you and a couple of other, YouTubers that I follow. Actually, some of the Hermitcraft people that we mentioned earlier. Are British, and I've been picking up some more British slang that I'm then using instead of swear words. You know, like instead of saying something is, well, I mean, I think my favorite, and this is innocent actually, but I find it really funny when people call something pants and they mean that it's bad or it's shitty.
Oh, that it's like rubbish. Yeah,
it's rubbish. You know, it pants. I think the reference is that it's underpants, like it's dirty underpants. Like I think that's the short version of just calling something pants. And I think I find it very fun. It's also nice to have some unique family friendly things to say on a stream, right? And not like if you're really upset with something on, you know, that's going on a stream and you want to be colorful about it. Then you can do something like that. I've actually had a couple people also, cause I've used some phrases before, they're not particularly nice. They still fall within family friendly, but I said something on stream the other day. It's like not the sharpest crayon in the box. And somebody in my stream was just like, I am putting that in my vocabulary. That is hilarious. I said, thanks. It's not the nicest thing to say to somebody. So don't go throwing it around. Like don't use it without knowing what you're saying. Like, cause you're calling someone dumb, but it's got layers, you know, like crayons, not sharp to begin with. And then calling someone a dull crayon, it's like, you know, the crayons that are like nubs and they're down to the paper and you got to peel them before you can use them again. Like that's what I was talking about.
Oh,
and
so
we had a good laugh about it in chat, but yeah, it's, the whole week has kind of had me on a sweary edge and we don't talk about weather normally, but I'm going to break the rules because just a week ago, the Weather Channel was still issuing frost warnings. So like at night, it was getting down to like, you know, 2 degrees. Inland, it would have been cooler. So, you know, like if you had planted crops, you know, as a farmer, then like you got to be careful because you could potentially have like, you know, some frost kill your crops, you know, early in the season. And then this week, it's been hitting like 27 degrees Celsius. In the city, and like it is overnight, it has gone from like the first 27 degree day, there were no leaves in the trees. Like not even joking, there were not even buds, and we had a day where it was 27 degrees. And then a week later, the buds are happening and everything's going around. And then this week we've had like 2 or 3 days where it's been well over 24, 25. And now of course like leaves are out, everything's it's full on summer. We had no spring. It was like snowing 2 weeks ago in May. Frost warnings a week ago, and now it's 25 degrees. It is bizarre. And it also means that every pollen producing plant is now, it's all happening at once. It's like when Garfield was taken out of the dryer in the comics and he kind of goes like, and just my head. One of the other reasons I can't sleep, it's like I get hay fever and my allergies over the last little while have just been bananas. And you and I were speaking last night, we were supposed to record, and I had a headache yesterday from 3 o'clock in the afternoon until 1 a.m. And it just, nothing I could do could get rid of it. And it's why we didn't record last night. It's why the show's late this week. And it's just this combination of like lack of sleep, tension headache, and hay fever. And I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. Like, I don't understand what is going on in the world right now environmentally, but we need to do something to stop it because it is backwards. Like, how long have you been in Canada now? Like 5 years, 6 years?
I came in 2014.
So 6 years.
Beginning of, I was right. So 6 years. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, have you noticed a change in the weather around here in 6 years? Because I imagine you'd be aware of it more because you would have been seeing new kind of weather patterns even when you arrived. Like, they would have been different from being home, right?
Oh, God,
have you
yes.
noticed a
I mean,
big
it's,
change?
It's the same variety that we got back home, but just so much more extreme. Winter seemed to be less harsh now than when I first arrived. And winter is shifting as well. So it feels like winter is kind of happening a little bit later. And it also seems to be
white
shorter.
Christmases.
Yeah, and it seems to be shorter now as well. Like, I feel like we're hitting, that we're hitting spring a lot sooner. But I don't know, I'm still not sure as to whether, like, the spring to summer ratio has changed kind of thing.
I find spring getting really short. Like, I find, like, spring, quote-unquote spring around here, ends up being, like, snow and rain for April. And then after that, you're straight into summer. For me, it doesn't seem to be. But the biggest thing that I'm noticing.
It's very quick cross-dissolve transition, effectively.
Yeah. The thing that I noticed so much about the summers around here is that we never used to have heat waves. And now in the Maritimes, we're getting like 2 weeks or more at the end of July and August where it's like heat warnings and like temperatures are approaching 40 with the Humidex. And it's just like, and that's new in the last 5 years, I want to say.
That was a selling point to me when I first came, because I came on holiday. But for those who don't know, I came on holiday in August of 2013, and I stayed for 2 weeks and absolutely loved it. So much so I came back. But it was in August, height of summer, and it was so nice with just how hot it was, and also how surprisingly less humid it was than over in England. Because that's one of the things in England. It can get pretty hot in England. Not for very long periods, but when it does, it gets pretty humid and it's gross, especially if you're on public transport. Like in London, it's the worst being on the tube in the height of summer. It is just, you're just inhaling sweat. Yes, that's it exactly. So I apologize to everybody who's just had to deal with that mental image. But yeah, coming here, like, I just found it so much easier to breathe, and it was really nice. And I was like, if summer's always like this, and I was told, yep. I'm like, okay, that's on my list. It wasn't like an immediate decision. Like, it took a few months for me to decide to move back, but a few being, I think it was like 2 or 3 months. So really not that long. I really like how warm it gets, and it's not so dry because we are on the coast here as well, which also helps.
Well, yeah.
It's the Goldilocks zone.
Yeah. So, but in those 5 years, 6 years that you've been here, have you noticed like a big shift in summers as well being here?
I don't know, to be honest. I think there's certainly been, I'm saying I'm not sure because the first apartment I lived in was basically a greenhouse. And so we were kind of sweating to death in there. Like it was great when you went outside. Inside, it was bad. I found that the last couple of years have been a bit more bearable indoors. But I've perhaps been feeling a little bit more tired outdoors. But again, I'm also getting older, so I don't know how much is the environment and how much is just my body wearing out slowly over time as the years pass.
Yeah, I want to say it started. I really noticed it in like 2018. That's when I really started to notice the heat waves and stuff here. Maybe even 2017. But 2017, 2018, because 2017 is when I got into hiking. And I started to do a lot more coastal hikes around here because of the break that it gave you from being in the city in really hot weather. But I think overall that it's been the last 5 years where things have been drastically different. So I don't know that you would notice from like 2014, 15 to now, but I noticed from like growing up, you know, and what the summers and the weather was like around here in the summertime. Yeah. To now, I feel like it's a lot warmer. But again, like, I mean, I've been in the same apartment now for almost 20 years. So it's one of those things where, like, I've been in this place and I can feel the difference. Like, I can tell that it's not as comfortable as it used to be. I mean, I have an AC unit, but that doesn't do any good when you're doing content creation that requires a microphone because that can't be on next to me. Like, it would be just an impossible situation. I might be able to stream if I wasn't making wasn't turning it into YouTube content. I could maybe put the AC in the other room, and you would be able to hear it, but it wouldn't be like the end of the world. You know, for example, there might be some construction going on outside my window right now that people can hear, but like, just it is what it is. I have to leave the window open.
I still don't have AC. Like, in England, it's not a thing. Like, it's something that like businesses will have, but it's not something that you as a person would have in your home. So it's still such an alien concept to me. Like, I'm sure it would be hugely beneficial for me, but it's not ever something that I really think of. Like, for me, at the most, it's like you have a fan. I have a really terrible fan. It plugs into USB. It's very small.
You need to get a decent fan, my friend.
I know, but that's what I've been living on. I didn't even have a dehumidifier. I didn't even know that was a thing that we were entitled to. The guy who lived in the apartment before me took it. So there wasn't even one here when I moved in. And I didn't find out until like 2 years later when I'm talking to my landlord. It's going, it's really bad. And they're like, well, how's your dehumidifier? I'm like, what now? I didn't know this was a thing. Wait, it just takes the moisture out of the air? This sounds great. And they're like, well, do you want one? Yes, please. how much does it cost? Well, you're supposed to have one anyway, so it's free. So I was very, very excited about it. Very simple things excite me when it's like this. But yeah, that has made a world of difference. But that too is loud, and like pretty much every day you're constantly having to empty the bucket.
Yeah. My AC unit does have a dehumidify mode, and it's a godsend in the heat of summer. It'll make a big difference. So, but anyway, I digress. I just had to get that off my chest as to why this week has just been upside down. I appreciate the patience of all the patrons of the Sizzle Cafe on Patreon that have been waiting for the latest episode and for everybody out there. We have actually, speaking of the show, we've seen a really solid uptick in downloads and listeners. So welcome to all the new people. And it's exciting because I've been doing this show for a very long time and it's been pretty steady. It hasn't really grown a lot, I want to say, in the last 5 years. But in the last 5 to 6 months, I've seen quite a lot of people come in new to the show, which is, it's just fantastic. It's great to know that you're reaching some new listeners. We're actually going to be talking about some older stuff. So, and some of the new listeners might be young enough that they might not know about these films, depending on where and when you grew up and what kind of things you liked to watch. More fitting guest than Alistair McFly to have on the show, because over the last week, the weekend into this week, was feeling nostalgic, and I went back and watched the Back to the Future trilogy. Yes, the one directed by Robert Zemeckis, starring Michael J. Fox, Christopher Lloyd, Thomas F. Wilson, Leah Thompson, and Crispin Glover. And, of course, the iconic score by Alan Silvestri. I was surprised how well these 30-plus-year-old films stood up.
They really do.
Yeah. Having gone back and watched the Jurassic Park movies recently, I want to say it's even better than the original Jurassic Park in terms of the level of quality. They're adventure movies, like they're family adventure movies, so you know what you're getting. But yeah, like the first one from 1985 it's just a really fun film. Right? Like they're fun. They're meant to be adventurous and fun. They have a solid plot. Like, I mean, it's pretty straightforward. But they're just really, really well done. And I remember liking them. I remember watching them as a kid. I've watched them since. I don't remember when I watched them more recently. I don't know that I've necessarily seen them since they came out on streaming, or since streaming services have kind of taken over my streaming and movie watching stuff. I think the last time I watched the Back to Future trilogy, I was putting DVDs into a machine. So it's probably been 10 plus years since I've seen them.
I've owned it on many formats as well.
Yeah. So when's the last time you watched it?
So you and I were talking just before the show as well about how I definitely watched it in 2015. I have seen them once since, but I'm not sure when. Normally it's the kind of trilogy that I watch a lot, but I think after just all the hype from 2015, I took a little bit of a break from things. But for anybody who hasn't listened to one of the shows from back then, what I did was I timed everything perfectly. So I watched the first movie, and then I watched the second movie, and I timed it so that when Doc and Marty arrive in 2015... that was on the exact same date at the same time that they arrive. So I timed it up perfectly and it worked, and it was just the best. It was the best experience, and I'm really glad that I did it that way.
Yeah, that's really cool. I'm not sure what episode of the Siddle Cafe, but you've talked about it before, and I think it was one of our nerdy reminiscent video, like what did you do that was nerdy this week, something like that. Because I've known you for that long, so it was on one of those shows. But yeah,
That would have been October 21st, 2015, because that's the date they travel to in the movie.
Right, so it would have been after that.
It would have been sometime just after then. I think you were saying it may have been like the end of year. Like, what did you do big this year?
Possibly, the Christmas episode where I have everybody on, we just kind of have a round table.
So I think it was that one. Yeah.
And worth noting too, that I'm pretty good about tagging, like putting tags on blog posts and stuff when I do the show notes. So if you're looking for something particular, going back to the archives in the Siddle Cafe, there's a search function on the website. If you just type in like the movie or the guest or whoever, you'll get a decent return in terms of the searches, and might be able to figure out between the topic search and the year as to when that might be. I'm pretty sure that I call them all holiday roundtables. So like you can probably go back and actually find all the roundtables. Either way, it's going to be the last episode of every year. Like right around mid-December is when I usually do them. So they're easy to find too. And they're always really fun because there's usually like four or five people on the show at a time, which is really fun. So to focus on the first one, because that's the one that I watched. It was like a solid movie night. Like I made homemade nachos. The only thing I didn't have was a beer, but because the liquor store that was near me is closed. So like I really had a solid movie night. And I had been spending a lot of time on the computer and doing a lot of work. So it was nice to kind of like go into the living room and realizing that I really need to replace my headphones for my home audio system, because I, in an apartment, when I want to watch a movie, I prefer headphones because then I'm not disturbing anybody. I can have it as loud as I want and all that kind of stuff. But I really need to replace them because the music and the sound and all the cool effects in the original are just really classic kind of movie effects. You know, like revving engines of cars and the DeLorean, and like they're trying to make all these sound effects in 85 that sound like a time machine. Like it's just, it's really, really cool stuff. And the music too, like not just the score, but like there's the iconic scene with Marty on stage playing Johnny B. Goode, which when I was a kid is like, it's the coolest thing ever. You know, like it's such a fun film. And the things that I pulled away from it, like I don't think we need to break down the plot and things for people. I think most people are probably familiar, but when Marty goes back to 1955, there's just something really classy I built like the post-World War II 40s and 50s. And just the dress and like the way people acted and the colors of everything are so straightforward. Like there's not a lot of patterns. It seems to be just a lot of really solid colors in places. Mm-hmm. And a lot of primary colors. Like these days, in even like in architecture and fashion, you get a lot of black and gray and brown and like a lot of earth tones. But back then it was just like teal or red, or, you know, or if the car was black, it would have like red hubcaps. It's like just really, really, really cool stuff.
Yeah. Either vibrant colors or pastels and stuff. Whereas yes, now we're kind of going towards like dystopian kind of looks and feels.
No, yeah, no, the pastel, like the pastel diner, you know, like the teal, the teal green or the teal blue kind of diner look with like chrome and everything's white and teal. And it's just, it has that classic kind of feel to it. And there's a diner in downtown Dartmouth. It's now somebody's basement. The guy that used to own it probably just lives upstairs, I guess, but it still has the stools and the chrome around the counter. Like it'd be so cool eventually when things open back up again, if that was turned into like, you know, like a milkshake spot or something.
There's actually a place in London that, in fact, there's a chain of them. I've forgotten the name of the chain now, but in London, there are these restaurants that have done in that style, and they've got the, like the jukebox machines where you just, you know, put in your money and sort of select from your table. And those are all originals. They're not mock-ups or anything like that. But yeah, they have that whole 1950s diner experience. It looks exactly the same. It's incredible. And I'd love to go to another one like that over here, for example. And they did amazing milkshakes as well.
So when I was a kid, I had the biggest crush on Leah Thompson from Back to the Future. I'm sure a lot of people probably did. It then went tenfold because later on in like the mid 90s, she starred in Caroline in the City on TV.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. I used to love watching that show.
And she was a cartoonist.
Yeah. Oh, so, of course.
So,
yes.
So it's like the light from heaven came down and it was just like, like you remember this lady that you had a crush on as a kid? But going back and watching the original Back to the Future, it reminded me of that weird feeling of like really identifying with Marty, because I didn't see Back to the Future when it came out in theaters. I would have only been 6. So it was a little bit too young. I was a little bit too young for it.
That's but what I would how have old seen... I was when the third one came out.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So we'll get to that because I saw I saw the third one in the theaters. But the in 1985, I was too young. So I would have seen it for the first time on home video, probably more likely on television when they used to run like Saturday afternoon or Saturday evening matinees, that sort of thing. And I remember feeling really weird about it because like you could tell that it was the same actor. You knew that it was Leah Thompson playing his mom in 1985 and in 1955. And it was his mom. Like you got that. But you as a kid, as a young boy, are identifying with Marty, right? But then you're seeing Leah Thompson is like playing his mom and you've got this like crush on her because she's very pretty. And you're just like, but that's his mom. That's weird. Yeah. And so you feel the same conflict. Like she's a mom character. I'm not supposed to like the mom character, you know? And for whatever reason, I just recall that kind of like weird conflict that you felt. It works really well. It still stands up. Especially because she's so flirty. Like she's such a prude in the original way that they portray her before the time shift in 1985. And then in 55, she's like got her hand on his thigh and he's just like jumping out of his skin. Like there's some really, really fun moments.
Yeah. They were actually, that almost caused the movie to not even get made. There was a lot of studios that kind of turned it down.
Right.
And there was even a deleted scene, which they removed because it has Marty just saying, so when I go back to 1985, and am I going to be into incest or something after doing this? And it's just like, this is hitting a little too close to home as to the reality of the situation. So they took that out, thankfully. But it's one of those things where it's like, they make it clear that he has to kind of hit on his own mother. But at the same time, they do it in a way that doesn't cross the line in a bizarre. It's a remarkable balance they achieved with it anyway.
Yeah, because I mean, for, at the end of the film, when he has to like park with her outside, the idea is that they make out and they, you know, fool around before they go into the dance, and it's supposed to make her uncomfortable so that George McFly, Marty's dad, can then come and punch him. This is something else, and this is an adult subject, but something else I did notice about the film is, even as cartoony as it is and as lighthearted and as a family-friendly kind of film as it is, like, Biff tries to rape her. It's it's really obvious. And I, being so young, first watching these and then maybe tuning it out a little bit, because I've seen them throughout my life. I watched them as a teenager. I watched them, you know, as an adult. You know, I've seen them in the last 10 years. But it was just painfully obvious to the point where, like, this is like inappropriate. Or, and I shouldn't say inappropriate, because like they portrayed it in a way that is inappropriate, and you feel anger, like you get pissed off when it happens. But I didn't pick up as a young man, like as a young boy, on what's his mom's name? Lorraine.
Yeah.
Yeah, on Lorraine's fear, like when she, it's no longer Marty in the car, when it's Biff, and he's trying to get with her, the acting and the level of like, George, help me, it was palpable, and I don't remember that from when I saw it as a much younger kid, and I think because I wasn't doing podcasting about films and stuff like that the last time I watched them, I maybe wasn't paying attention to all the little things. And I was just like, oh yeah, I've seen this before. You know, I mean, I might not even pause these movies when I get up and, you know, go get snacks or something like that, because I've seen them before. But yeah, like it was really, really off-putting. And I don't mean that in a bad way. Like, I reacted to it the way that you should react to it. Like, it's really disturbing, and you're glad that it doesn't happen, and like all this kind of stuff. But it just kind of underlined the way that movies used to be made, and the stuff that they would portray as not lighthearted, but it would have been received differently back in 85 when it was made, that scene, in terms of like, oh yeah, well, that's what happens. Like, boys try to get with girls like that. Like, it was kind of like this just acceptable thing. Whereas like these days, I think it would have been a lot different had they shot that movie now.
Yeah.
Something else that I really noticed as well is that despite the fact that it's an older film, unlike Jurassic Park, which I thought was, I noticed as a much slower pace than most modern films. Back to the Future is pretty fast. They really start, they don't beat around the bush very much. It's the plot really drives things forward quite quickly. And it really, as a film I've seen before, it doesn't take a while to get going. Like, you're not constantly waiting for stuff. There's something cool happening or neat happening all the time. Now, some of that is nostalgia. Like, you know, there's the opening music, and there's like the big clockwork Rube Goldberg machine in Doc's place that, like, you know, feeds the dog and makes the eggs and like all that kind of stuff. So there's something visual about it, and it does have a slow credit scene, but like after that, it's go, go, go.
Well, the thing is that opening scene tells you so much that they can skip over. That opening scene sets up everything to the point that they don't have to drag it out, because basically the camera pans around. So you see, as Joel was just saying, you get the, food being dispensed and all this kind of stuff. So you immediately get, okay, so this belongs to somebody who makes really wacky inventions. There's also a ton of clocks on the wall. So an obsession with time. You have Marty sort of stepping in to the room and stuff, and you're not actually seeing Marty, you're just seeing like his shoes, and you're hearing him talking to Einstein and stuff, and you're seeing him kind of fiddle around with some things. But you also see him kick a skateboard under the bed, and it hits a box of plutonium. You then hear a news report about plutonium that's been stolen. And so in a very short space of time, you've already kind of got a gist as to, who Doc might be, the kind of things that he's already done and gotten up to, without having to spend too long going over it. And there's even some references there. Like
there's a newspaper article. I don't remember exactly what it said. At the time, I was like, oh, yeah, okay. You pick up on a lot of that kind of stuff. But, it was something to do with the story. I don't remember what it was, though.
Yeah, it's... I think that was about the terrorism, I think, if I recall. But there's so many little details. Like, one of the clocks even has a character hanging off. It's basically Harold Lloyd from a movie from the 20s called Safety Last. And it really kind of predicts, in a way, what will happen with Christopher Lloyd as he's hanging off the clock tower towards the end of it. So there's a lot of little subtle details that they kind of squeeze in here and there as well. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's so good to go back to, is just because it's just chock full of all sorts of details. Like, everything you look at has a purpose for being there, rather than just being haphazardly thrown in.
Yeah, I Googled it real quick, but it's just a whole article about all the different things you have to look for. And they really start to layer that kind of stuff in. Mm. And you might know this. Did they write all three at the same time? Or did they kind of... One was its own thing, and then two and three happened at the same time.
Yeah, in fact, when you watch the original theatrical release, the local cinema to me ended up getting the original reels and ended up hosting like a Back to the Future night and stuff, which was really cool. But the original theatrical release is just the end. There's no to be continued. That to be continued got added into the VHS release when it finally got released then, because they were like, okay, we're actually going to make a sequel now. But yeah, it was only ever intended to be a standalone film. The bit at the very end where Doc comes back from the future and is like, it's your kids, Marty. Something's got to be done about your kids. That whole scene was literally just because the pace had gone down and they wanted something energetic and exciting to end the film on. They had no plans for what would actually happen when they got to the future for Back to the Future 2. That was
so worth noting on Netflix, which is how I watched them. There is no to be continued at the end of Back to the Future, but there is at the end of Back to the Future 2. So
yes,
it just in the end of the first one, there is that scene of obviously with Doc Brown coming back and we don't need roads, you know, one of my favorite Hollywood lines ever.
Mm.
They shoot off into the camera and it goes black and then it just runs the credits. It just does the music and stuff like that. You're done.
Yeah.
And
modern releases.
I think it's not the score. I think it's like Huey Lewis in the News or like some 80s rock jam that they play.
Yeah. Yeah. Huey Lewis did a few songs for the film, and actually that's hit number one in 1985 with Power of Love, which was written for the movie,
which I think is the opening scene.
It's when Marty's sort of skating around, it's basically once he leaves the Doc's sort of, when he leaves Doc's place, then mm-hmm. that's the movie. He's kind of skateboarding to school when he realizes he's late, and it's also and it's also some Huey Lewis music that he's playing when he's trying to do his audition for the
band thing. Yeah, for the talent
and
show.
And Huey Lewis is the one who tells him that he's playing too darn loud.
Is that really Huey Lewis?
That's him, yeah. That is Huey Lewis as a cameo looking
I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, because of the way they've got his hair and his glasses and stuff, he just looks like this really boring principal. And he just grabs a megaphone and goes, you're just too darn loud when he's playing one of his songs.
There's a lot of little things like that I don't know. That's really, really cool. But yeah, overall, I enjoyed watching the first film again. Decent performances from everybody. I find all the characters in like 85 that are like with the prosthetic makeup and the way that they act old is really terrible. Like it's not the best. And I know this from pop culture and I can't unsee it or unthink about it, and that Crispin Glover is just weird. He's an odd dude, and everything I get that George McFly is supposed to be a weird dude, but everything is just, it's not good acting at all. It's just so over the top. And you get that from other characters too. Like Doc Brown is also kind of a cartoon character in the first film, but not so much in the others. One of my favorite things, I guess we can kind of move on to part two now. One of my favorite things about Back to the Future Part 2, which is my least favorite, I really don't like this one. I watch it because I kind of have to when you're watching the trilogy. But I think one of the shining moments in Part 2, which came out in 1989, 4 years later, is that they really gave Christopher Lloyd some meatier stuff to talk about and to act from. And you get a much broader sense of Doc is just not a cartoon mad scientist. Like, he's a person and he has feelings and goals and he cares about Marty and Marty's future. And like, there's all these different things. And also like the sense of wonder that he has about like the future and all this kind of stuff. He's still eccentric. Like, don't get me wrong. He's still out there, but they just do such a really good job of getting him some somber moments. He's not always so high octane. He can deliver some calm lines to Marty when they have something serious to talk about. And I really enjoyed that balance in the second film.
Yeah. It's also a very different shift for him as well from 1 to 2. Because in the first one, he's learned that one of his adventures will work and it'll be something as amazing as time travel. He then waits 30 years to be able to do it himself. And then when he goes to the future and comes back, he realizes things aren't quite so rosy. I need to fix things. And then it quickly declines into, I need to destroy the time machine. I should have never made it in the first place. So what we're getting in just like a short space of time with Marty is his realization of change over more than 30 years.
Yeah. And there's some real shoehorned stuff in the Back to the Future Part 2, which I think are only there because they're essentially part of the character motivations in Part 3, and they needed them, so they kind of forced them into Part 2. I don't normally watch them all so close together, but the first thing that I noticed, of course, with the opening scene in Back to the Future Part 2 is that they recast Jennifer. I was just like, oh, wait, that's not the same actor. No, it's Elizabeth Shue, I think, right? In
it is, yes.
The second one? Yeah.
She was doing a heck of a lot with like Cocktail. She done Babysitting.
Adventures in Babysitting, yeah. One of my sisters.
Adventures in Babysitting, that's the one. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So the original actress for her, which was Claudia Wells, she was set to return, but she had to back out because her mother was ill. I believe it was cancer. So she decided to drop out of acting to do that. And that's still like her main role that she's done. She was able to return to the franchise to voice Jennifer in the Back to the Future, the video game. And and I think there was something else where she did like I think she did a voiceover, possibly in the cartoon as well. But so she's been able to return to the role a couple more times. But yeah, that's the reason why she was recast, and they had to reshoot the entire intro or the end of the previous movie again. And Christopher Lloyd's portrayal in that scene, like, he's got so much more energy in the second one than he did at the end of the first one. I feel like he did actually perform it a little bit better second time around.
Yeah, I mean, but you don't really notice the difference. Like, you just...
Oh, no. It's because they wanted it to be as the same as possible, but not for you to suddenly, you know...
Yeah.
Like, after the credits go, why is that a different woman? Why has she completely changed her face?
Yeah. No, they did a really good job. I like how they do this with these films where the beginning of one is always exactly where the other one left off, and they can do that because of the time travel. So it's the same scene, but you're not necessarily watching the same characters. So like, a really good example is not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but in the beginning of Back to the Future Part 3, it's the clock tower scene from the end of the first film. But instead of seeing the thing over again, you get to see what happened after Marty goes back to the future, and where Doc is there celebrating in the street. And then Marty comes back from the future again. And like, he's back from the future, and then Doc faints, and it's all anyway, but they do these loops really, really well to kind of like, just take 3 minutes to kind of like get the audience back into the last little bit of the scene before, the film before. And of course, brilliantly, they have the other films to draw on, so they can intercut like you know, Marty running towards downtown, the clock tower, and then they cut to a shot of Marty in the DeLorean just before it goes back to 1985, which they've had since 1985 when they shot the first film. Like the way that they directed the transitions from one film to the next are really, really cool. Surprisingly, I don't have as much trouble with the time travel stuff as I thought I would. It all kind of just makes sense for the sake of the film. Especially after watching Avengers Endgame, where they literally say, no, time doesn't work like that. Back to the Future is bullshit.
Yeah. It was one of those ones where it's probably one of the easiest forms of, because like every time travel movie needs to have its own rules that it has to abide by and follow. Mm-hmm. And as long as you buy into those rules, it's fine and it works.
Fine.
And they bought into their rules of time travel so well. And it made it enjoyable and didn't cause issues with narrative in that regard, which is good. And it also, as a kid, watching Back to the Future 2, like, because I know you've said that it's not your favorite, but for me it was growing up, because one, I got to see the future, which was just hella cool.
Which is 5 years ago now.
yeah, I know. And it was a darker film for sure. I think one of the other things is there's no conclusion. You don't get your conclusion until the third film. It is just the middle. So there's, you know, so you don't get that satisfying part of it. But my mind was always blown just over the concept of paradoxes, which I hadn't even heard of before because I was so young. And so just wrapping my head around the idea of a paradox was really, really cool. And that I loved.
Yeah, I think that they, for as careful as they are, or they say they're supposed to be, they get really careless in part two, and that allows Biff to then overhear them and take the DeLorean back and give the book to his younger self and all this kind of stuff.
Oh, when he's kind of hiding behind the door.
The door, and
Doc's not exactly talking quietly either. He's pretty vocally loud about it.
Loud, you know, and there's something really cartoonish about the acting, and it really kind of bugs me about the part two. And it's everyone. It's not just the key things that you notice. Like, people that watch it after hearing me say this are going to notice specifically Griff, played by Thomas F. Wilson. And they explain that Griff has got like a short circuit in some of his bionic implants. It's like a throwaway line. Well, not a throwaway line. It's a character beat that Doc puts into the conversation with Marty. Hey, look, by the way, watch this guy. He's got a screw loose sort of thing. But just the way that they do the over-the-top acting from all of the future teenagers, like, they're all just weird. I've always thought that. I was like, gee, that's really strange. But it just kind of grated on me. But the logic in part two, surprisingly, it's not the time travel logic that I have a problem with. It's all the other stuff. It's like all the sneaking around and not being noticed. And like, there's a part where Marty is in the back seat of Biff's convertible and he's on the walkie-talkie with Doc.
Yes.
As if Biff can't hear him. Like, he's a foot away from him. Like, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, even if you can accept the fact that he doesn't catch him in this peripheral, which you imagine he should do at least at one point. The microphone. I mean, it's one of those things where narratively they need that communication. But yeah, he's talking way too loud. Even with the sort of the loudness of the engine, it's still not going to drown it out. Biff would still have heard him.
No, and they do some things in the film to try to indicate that Biff isn't paying attention. He turns up the radio to listen to a sports broadcast and then check the almanac to be like, huh, okay, so this thing actually is right. Yeah. But between that and the way, there's so much. Actually, it reminded me of the Warner Brothers TV shows that we often complain about, because there's so much repeated dialogue. Like, every time Marty picks up the bloody walkie-talkie, it's like, Doc, Doc, come in, Doc, are you there, Doc? Like, it's all the time. It's half of what he says in the movie is, Doc, Doc, are you there? Like, just, oh my God, I get it. You're trying, he's the only person with the other walkie-talkie.
The other thing to think about, though, is that Marty is a teenager.
Yes,
and for him, this is kind of, he's drawing what he has to do based on other things. Like, Doc tells him to get a disguise, but to get something inconspicuous. So he gets like a black leather jacket with
Blues
a black
Brothers
hat and glasses. And it's basically like everything that would make him stand out more. He is not inconspicuous in the slightest. And it's really just his inexperience just being a teenager. that that. So I think that, you know, he's given a walkie-talkie, which back then, you know, was still, you know, I mean, kids would have walkie-talkies, but they were still relatively new for kids to really be playing with, I think.
Yeah.
And so to be kind of in a serious situation, not using walkie-talkies for fun, but like, this is, we need to communicate this way, I think would have been different back then.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that you can sort of get past it in the first film, especially because, I mean, obviously Michael J. Fox was on Family Ties. Actually, he was still doing Family Ties. I think he was filming Back to the Future in the evenings. Like he was originally.
Yes.
Who were they? Who did they have originally for
Eric Stoltz?
Eric Stoltz, because they wanted Michael J. Fox, but then they had to wrestle with the other studio to get him to be able to film while he was shooting Family Ties. But in the second film, Michael J. Fox is 28, and I think as an adult, you pick up on the fact that he is not a teenager. Like, he's not 17, even though he's still playing a 17-year-old. And in all three of these films, he's supposed to be 17, right? And he's almost 30, you know, even though he's a short age. Oh, youthful looking, and he's a short dude. Like, so he kind of pulls it off. Also Canadian, by the way. But yeah, like that kind of stuff was interesting. But like I said, the stuff like that pulls me out of it. I also found that they shoehorned in needles. I could have sworn, if you had asked me about this trilogy and said like, oh, hey, do you remember Needles, the bully that Marty has to deal with in 1985? I would be like, oh, yeah. Though they just like Biff from 1955 that George had to deal with, Marty has to deal with Needles. Except for Needles isn't in the first film at all. Completely, feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think he's in the first film.
He's not, no. In fact, he's played by Flea. So, is a musician. I've forgotten he was basically a musician that was sort of tied into it.
Yeah. So the whole thing with like this relationship with Needles in part two, I was like, where did this come from? I've never heard of this guy. Cause again, I just watched these all back to back this weekend. So it's like, this is all brand new. I don't understand. I don't understand this at all. And then in part two and three, they portray it like Needles has just always been this, antagonist to Marty, when it's just not been the case. It's always been Biff. Biff has always been the big, you know, big antagonist the film.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is that Biff was the bully from the 50s to his father. So the idea is that you think that that Needles is basically that to Marty, but because we don't see him at school much in the 80s, then that's why, because we just didn't really see much of that. I just had a quick look up as well. Flea was from the bassist for Red Hot Chili Peppers.
I thought you meant.
I just couldn't remember exactly the name of the band there, but But yeah, and I think that's why. It's one of those, you know, he's got this life at school. We just haven't seen it yet because he spent most of his time in the 50s.
Yeah. I think that was the other thing, too, that I felt fell flat. And we'll get into this in part three, because they did a pretty good job, but they could have done better in that. Marty's relationship with Jennifer is they're boyfriend, girlfriend, and they love each other only because the movie tells you that they do. Like, you don't get enough time necessarily with them for it to feel earned or authentic. And actually Marty's kind of really inappropriate in the first film, in Back to the Future part one. Like, there's early in the movie, they're sitting on a park bench, I think, outside of the clock tower, and they're basically kissing, and he gets a little bit handsy, and he's like, dude, like, this, you're in public. Like, it felt awkward. But well, I mean, a sign of the time it was filmed in, and I'm not giving that as an excuse, but it's a reminder of how things have changed. But it was one of those things where it's like, you don't, watching it now, you don't necessarily think, oh, they're in love. You think, oh, he wants to get in her pants. Like, you don't think of him as quite that way until she gives him, I think it's like her father's number or something, and she says, I love you, and writes down the phone number.
Grandparents.
But then when he sees that, he gets all kind of Twitter-pated. And then you get a little bit of a, like a more of a, of a, of a good-natured feeling about the whole thing. But really that's all you get. You just, you only get that note that says that they're a couple and that they're worth fighting for. Like it's, other than that, it's just kind of side story stuff, which is too bad. But what was nice about the third one, and I'm going to give people a little bit of a heads up at the end of part two, because they were filmed back to back, there is that to be continued. And then even on Netflix, before they roll the credits, they launch into essentially a trailer for part three.
That's always been there. That has always been part of it.
Yeah. And I remember seeing that when I was a kid, but if you haven't seen these in a while, don't watch it. Cause I stopped it about 30, 40 seconds in. They're like, oh geez. It's like, it's all the best scenes. It's all the best scenes from part three. So don't watch the trailer. Mm. Just after part two, when the 2B continued shows up, just stop it. Just stop it there and go and watch the part three. Cause part three is my favorite. Like it high, far and above the other two films, as far as enjoyability and just fun. And it still manages to be funny, but not as cartoonish. And they it's because like the characters aren't making jokes for the sake of making jokes, and they're not making jokes like talking to themselves. It's, there's always another character in the scene, or they're mumbling something like as another character walks away, or there's little references like. And I think part of it is that you've got the other three films, the other two films to draw on for references. And so they can make those things and you get it. I do really enjoy how they really tee you up for, you know, there's the storm. They successfully destroy the almanac, and then there's a lightning strike of the DeLorean, and Doc gets sent back in time. But you don't know what's happened until just moments later. Somebody from Western Union shows up and hands Marty a letter, and it's like, and he's reading this very important letter in the pouring rain where it's being probably disintegrated, but only because it's a movie prop letter is it not melting in his hand. And it obviously explains that Doc's in 1885. And then you have the whole scene where he runs back to the clock tower to try and get sent back to 1885, and they discover the DeLorean, and there's all these different things. But like, it's just such a cool overlap, because like Marty is just kind of like immediately remembers, wait a minute, Doc is still at the clock tower. If I run, I can probably make it there. I would imagine
you need
that
any help. There's only one man who can help me.
Yeah. I feel like for all of Back to the Future 2, all Marty did was run. all he did was run. Every scene, he's just running somewhere. And then they open up going into the start of Back to the Future 3. They really like refresh your memory as to what's going on. They do the whole scene again. Doc faints, and then they cut to the next morning, and then they go from there. But they really, I don't know what it is about the way that it's filmed. Just a year later. Maybe it's because they're just filming more outside and there's less sets. Maybe because it's just a brighter film altogether. But Back to the Future 3 just feels so different compared to 2. I don't mean from a writing standpoint. I mean from like a production standpoint. It just feels like a more of a modern movie. And I'm not sure what happened in that timeline, because they were filmed at the same time or back to back anyway. But yeah, I was 11 when Back to the Future 3 came out, and I distinctly remember seeing it in theater. I want to say it was a birthday party, maybe even mine. It could have been my buddy Scott's. I don't remember. Cause that, at that age, you just kind of went to everybody's birthday party. Like, you know, if you and your group of five or six friends, whoever had one, you were all there. And that was the thing that you did when the kids were 10, 11, was you went to the movies and you had pizza, essentially, in the late 80s, early 90s. And that I distinctly remember seeing in theaters and being old enough to appreciate the theater experience, you know, when you're 10, 11, just how fun that is and how big everything is and the music and the spectacle of it and the popcorn, all that kind of stuff. So
for me, that was Jurassic Park at that age.
And I want to say, it was even in one of the old single screen movie houses. It wasn't the Oxford Theater. There used to be a theater near or on what is now the Armdale roundabout.
Oh, wow. Really?
But it was back when it was the Armdale Rotary. And it was, I'm trying to remember what's on the corner now. I think it's a gas station that's there now. But somewhere in that vicinity, there was a theater. And I don't remember exactly where. It would have been somewhere near the bottom of, I guess it's Shabakto Road. I mean, everybody listening to the podcast has got no idea what I'm talking about.
Yeah, but, it's basically a big roundabout.
Yeah, but basically it's a section of the city here that's underseen a lot of change over the last 30 years, which is bizarre. May 25th, 1990, only 4 days ago, which is one of the reasons I wanted to talk about Back to the Future on the show this week, is that the finale of the trilogy is celebrating 30 years as of May 25th this year, which is just bonkers to think that these movies are 30 years old. Empire Strikes Back is 40 years old this year. And like, it just baffles the mind that the films are like, they still hold up. Because you think about Back to the Future, you kind of think about cheesy 80s movies. They're not that cheesy. Like, they're fun.
And the effects still hold up as well. Industrial Light and Magic's effects were great. The makeup, not so much, because it was never intended to be seen in high definition. So the jump to HD, certainly you can see all the lines where the prosthetic ends and the real skin begins.
But and now you've told me this story before, because they prematurely aged Christopher Lloyd.
Yes, they did. Yeah.
So the doc that you meet for the very first time actually has prosthetic makeup on.
Yeah. So when he's in the 80s, and so when you go back into the 50s, he looks 30 years younger. But it's still subtle. And in fact, it was even more so on VHS that when you go into the second one, he's in the aged makeup. But then he pulls it all off to say that he's been to a rejuvenation clinic. Change of blood and all this kind of stuff. Which, that would be great to be able to have one of those nowadays. Hopefully they can fix back pain as well. Because that makes me feel old. And then he takes it off. And he's like, what do you think? And Marty's like, you look great, Doc. And he really doesn't look that different, in all honesty.
The look on Marty's face is like, you look the same.
Yeah, that's it. Like, he peeled all the skin off. And even as a kid, especially on VHS with the quality that you had back then, I was just like, he doesn't look any different, you know? And it wasn't until it came out in HD that you can really notice it. But
I think the gag, too, is that, like, you know, when you're a kid, anybody older than 25 is just old.
Yeah.
Right. Like, it's just like, if you're not in school with me, you're an adult and therefore old. And you lump everybody from ages like, you know, 25, 30 to 50, all in the same old category. Mm-hmm. It's not until you're an adult where you start to like weasel things down into like little windows.
Plus he spent a week with young Doc and then just like hardly any time with old Doc, and then suddenly old Doc looks just like young Doc again. So it's also not really been that much time from Marty's perspective.
Yeah.
So it's just like,
I also feel like the white hair, they gave him the white hair in the 1985 film, and they did a much better job of it in the 80s. I didn't notice it as much I did notice it when they were in the future and when he was setting Marty up to go into the diner in Back to the Future 2. But in Back to the Future 3, Doc's white hair looks way more authentic. It doesn't look quite as fake. In 1985, they were like, you could see where they combed the white like hair dye into his eyebrows. Like, it was pretty obvious. Whereas in 1990 in Back to the Future Part 3, it all felt a lot more seamless. And everything about that film, I actually, watching it now in hindsight, because they filmed a good chunk, any of the big vistas, any of the big shots in Back to the Future Part 3 were filmed in Monument Valley, which is an area on the border of the Utah and Arizona state area. And it's home to like a lot of Westerns. They do a lot of American Southwest filming there, as well as some of the places that I've been to. I did not actually visit Monument Valley because it was too far south, and Utah is a huge state. But my vacation in 2017, I'm realizing was probably pretty heavily influenced by Indiana Jones, but also by Back to the Future 3. Having seen them at such a young age, I could not really figure out like why. I knew I had the podcasting convention in Nerdtacular in 2017. I knew it was going to be the last one. So I thought, well, hey, maybe I can do some sort of vacationing while I'm in that area. And I don't know why I chose hiking. I'm not sure what made me search for, like, it was probably because hiking is cheap and I didn't have a lot of money for like an expensive vacation. And, but I'm not sure what kind of led me to it. But the moment that I realized the kind of landscapes that were in South Utah, I was like, that's what I'm doing. That's what I'm doing for vacation this year. And I think a lot of it has to do with this kind of film, you know, like the Indiana Jones and the Back to the Future Part 3, the Western sort of South American or American Southwest vistas. Because immediately, especially now, because I've got some serious nostalgia from my last vacation, seeing the scene at the drive-in where Marty goes back in time and like having to drive away from the Native American brigade and the cavalries that are after him and all that kind of stuff that leads into the time shift to 1885 in the third film. It just really reminded me, I was like, wow, like this, I really do have like a love for this kind of scenery. And they just shot it so well. And I think one of the reasons why Back to the Future 3 works so much better, even from just forget all my nostalgia, but on the surface of the film, it's a Western, it's a Western and it's a character-driven Western first and a time travel movie second. Yeah, so you've got,
Yeah, they're not going back and forward as much as they do in the second one, for example. So she just get there and then we get back.
And there's not as much, there's not like you do one thing and then there's six things that you have to then fix in the timeline in order to put things right. It's like the one thing that they're there to do is get Doc home. Like that's the only reason Marty is there is to bring him back. And so it becomes like there's other plots interwoven. I mean, obviously Biff. And again, I'm not sure what it is. I mean, Mad Dog Biff Tannen he's a cartoon character. I get it. It's a Yosemite Sam, like in the flesh, but in the context, it's believable. Yeah. It's not as over the top as Griff. He's not as, I'm not sure what see 1955 Biff. There's also something cartoony about him, but it does sort of work. But with, for whatever reason, in part two, everything just feels fake. But in part three, Biff Tannen, he's like Mad Dog. He's believable. He's a believable Western villain, you know?
And not only that, he has a gun and he can get away with it. I mean, Biff in alternate 1985 could kind of get away with it because he fought out the cops. But, you know, like he's not afraid to stand there with his guns in front of the sheriff.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Western.
Yeah, no, exactly. And it's funny, I would say that I like Westerns, but I can't say that there's a lot of them that I've watched that I've liked. I've liked a few. They're a different pace.
I find that I'm kind of in the same kind of feeling as well. And it's because, and I know that this is entirely the reason, it's because I watched Back to the Future 3 as a kid, and that was probably the first Western I ever saw. Don't think I'd seen a Western before then. And so because of my love for the franchise and the characters and just how well those sets were made, and just the feeling that it evoked, every single Western since I've mentally compared to Back to the Future 3, if it feels like the Western we saw in Back to the Future 3, it almost feels like that's authentic. Like, it doesn't matter what actually happened in history. If I went back in time to the 1800s in America and I went to the Old West, I'd be like, well, this looks fake. Because this doesn't feel like Back to the Future 3. I almost established that in my head as that's what reality is. That's what it was actually like in the Old West, which I know is false and wrong. But the quality and standard is so high that I do definitely compare it against other things.
Yeah, no, it's really a fantastic tribute to Westerns. Like, you can tell that Gale and Zemeckis wanted to make a Western. Like, they're just like, we're just trying. They even plant the seed in Back to the Future 2, where it's just like Doc actually says something like, oh yeah, time circuits are messed up. It's like, oh man, I've always wanted to go back to the, you know, the old West or something like that. He might have even said it in the first one.
There's
a line that he says about it's being, it's his favorite time or favorite time period or something like that.
Yeah, in fact, there was an interview with Michael J. Fox, and I think this is actually where it came from initially, because he was asked if he could go back to any time, where would he like to go? And he said he'd like to go to the Old West. And I think that's kind of where, like, you know, and I'm sure, you know, Bob Zemeckis and Bob Gale would not have made it if they didn't want to do it as well. But I think that probably kind of cemented the, let's have him go to the Old West. You know, that would be kind of fun and cool.
There's some cool shots. Like, I mean, like Michael J. Fox, who as an actor at his age in the 80s and the kind of roles that he was probably getting, probably not going to be in a Western unless it's in Back to the Future. So it's kind of like your one shot. And like, you know, the walking into the saloon with the swinging doors and like the gun battle, like all those iconic Western things, you know, like, oh my, like, I can't tell you how just jealous I get of, I mean, I know they're stunt doubles in a lot of ways, but like just to jump on a horseback and gallop out of town to go chase a train or go somewhere as quickly, like, just, it is the coolest thing. There's something just, sort of alien, but then sort of badass about it. And just like, I should probably learn to ride a horse before I start daydreaming about actually riding horseback. I've been on them, but not in the way that I'm controlling it. It's just, it was like one of those like horse tours around Prince Edward Island or something like that. Nothing crazy. And I know some people that ride that could probably show me how if I ever asked them nice enough and had the time and the money.
Ride off into the sunset.
No, it's one of those things where like, well, and all through my hiking in Utah, like there was lots of horse trails. Like there was lots of just nature reserves and what are they called? Not offbeat. Can't remember the name of what they called the trails, but you could see, like, you'd be on your trail, like your hiking path, and then you'd see like a horse trail. Like you'd be able to see, oh, that's obviously where someone would come through here with a horse if they knew what they were doing, you know? And I just imagine that you'd just be able to see so much more and really kind of experience that like lonely Western sort of vibe. But it was one of those things, like, even if there was somebody that was, you know, doing horse guided tours of, you know, hiking areas in Utah, I wouldn't feel comfortable going because I've just not had enough time with an animal like that to feel comfortable. But boy, does it look cool when you get like the cowboy hat and the shawl and just, you know, they jump on the horse and they're galloping out of town. It's like, that's just, it's awesome.
I do love the fact that just like how Marty doesn't really know how to dress for the 50s when he's tasked to go buy clothes, the fact that he's given that dog ugly hat and you know, he kind of waltzes into town and he's just kind of like, I'm wearing authentic Western gear, and everybody's like, you look terrible.
This is not the fashion of the time. He's got like the howdy doody cowboy outfit on.
It's rough. They think he's from the circus, just like in the first one they thought that he was a lifeguard
in the Coast Guard because the life preserver vest that he had on. It's funny, I have a vest like that actually.
Oh, me too. I've got one
There was even Doc says it. It's like, Marty, you're gonna get shot. Who dressed you like that? And Marty's like, you did. And this is where some of the time travel stuff doesn't break down, because it's 1955 Doc that dressed him, so shouldn't future Doc remember that now? Like, it's just, there's a bunch of stuff that I find a little bit, it's they're fun lines, but you can't think about them too much. I enjoy the music, I enjoy the spectacle, I actually really enjoy the love story between Emmett Brown and Clara Clayton. Really, really, really good stuff. Is it Emma Steenburgen? Is it her first name Emma? Mary Steenburgen. Yeah. Saw her in a bunch of movies growing up as well, and she's got a very distinct voice. I find like her speaking voice is very unique. But she brings that she brings the damsel, you know, to the Western. There's actually a really good shot. It's when she's heartbroken and leaving Hill Valley for San Francisco, I think. It reminded me of some of the shots that I've seen since in television shows like Downton Abbey, which are set in the same sort of time period. They're a little bit later. They're turn of the century. But the low shot, the low camera angle of the train coming to the station and the steam coming off of the engine and the profile of people in period dress, like waiting on, I'm not sure what it is. It's not a gangplank. What? The platform? Platform. gangplank, wrong word. But like on the platform. And so you've got Mary Steenburgen or Clara in this purple period dress with like the big back, you know, like the hoop back on it. And she's got a hat and everything's all purple. Like it's an iconic shot. And one of those things that you don't notice when you're 12, you know, but when you watch it now, you're like, oh wow, this is a really nice shot. Really, really good stuff. And there's just so much about her that even though she's not a pushover, you know, like she kicks Biff Tannen in the shins and she slaps Doc when she thinks he's lying to her. Obviously still upset, but she still like stands up for herself in a lot of ways. Yeah. There's still something very romantic about the fact that she needs to be rescued, you know, in that when they first encounter her. It's a good role. I quite like that they gave Doc the love story and not Marty.
Yeah. And also the fact that, you know, Doc just has all these things like you can't do this, you can't change history. And then the moment he falls in love, he's just like, to hell with it.
Yeah.
Go on.
And it just dawned on me when I was watching it that she's the perfect person for him because she was supposed to go into the ravine.
Yeah.
Because it was named Clayton Ravine. And she, because she was supposed to die, that means that by marrying her and having a family with her, he doesn't affect history at all.
No.
Right, because she had no effect on history because she never made it past 1885.
Yeah, because you had the Shonash Ravine that then became the Clayton Ravine. And then after all this, I love that it becomes the Eastwood Ravine, which means that everybody knows that Marty, who's sort of donned the name Clint Eastwood for himself, you know, they're all kind of like, oh, well, he stole a train and then accidentally went off into the ravine. So it's named after him now, which is great. But two interesting things that I found out recently regarding Mary is that because they had a reunion again, no Crispin Glover. We know why.
Mm-hmm.
But they had a reunion for the anniversary, which was really cool. All done over Zoom and stuff. It's on YouTube. I've forgotten who it was who hosted it, but she actually was saying that the scene where she's on the horse chasing the train, that is her on the horse.
Oh, yeah.
No wires or anything. She was doing that. It's only when when the engine is exploding and she's gripping on and being flung backwards, that's her stunt double. But she still did things like she was on the horse riding super fast trying to chase down a train, which I thought was pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. There's a couple of scenes where you can tell that it would have to be stunt doubles. Like, you know, Michael J. Fox and Christopher Lloyd did not jump from their horses to the train. pretty sure that was the stunt double. But there's a lot of, but regardless of stunt double or not, there's a lot of practical effects in the climax of the film. It's a real train with real people, whether it's the actors for some scenes or the stunt doubles for others. Mm. And they had the advantage of both of these guys having great big hats and in some cases bandanas over their faces. So really filling in a stunt double was pretty easy. It leads up to one of my favorite lines in the film, which is when they finally get to the engine and they hijack the train and they tell the conductor to get off the train. He's like, is this a holdup? And Doc looks at Marty like, we're the good guys. And they're honest to a fault. It's like, it's a science experiment. It's so good. You know, I'm sitting on my balcony last night watching it on a tablet going like, for science. It's one of those things like for science is like a modern meme. Like it's something that happens. Like you hear that now, but for it to be used in 1990, it was so fitting. I thought it was great.
Did you notice the bandana that he was wearing in terms of the dot?
Oh no. I see, watching it on a tablet, it was clear. Okay. I was watching it because basically my audio was not great. My apartment was really warm last night. So I was on a nice cool balcony with my earbuds in, so I had better sound, but it's still only a 13-inch screen. Mm. So I didn't quite see the details on it.
The bandana was the shirt that he's wearing Back to the Future 2. And it's a shirt that's covered in trains and horses. So again, when we're talking about those little details that they kind of wangle in.
That's amazing.
They had that. One of the other things I found out recently was, are you familiar with Drew Struzan?
No.
So he is the guy who basically did the artwork for most of the movies that we grew up with. So you know how it's always got that kind of painted look? And he did the artwork for the Back to the Future ones as well. So,
oh, like the movie posters?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So he did all the movie posters, all the artwork for the covers. So the first one has Marty stepping out of the DeLorean. You've got the second one where it's Marty and Doc. And the third one was originally Marty and Doc. I'll send you the link, so then it will be in the show notes then as well. But it was just Marty and Doc that were in the picture with the train behind them. No Mary Steenburgen. No Clara Clayton. And that was very last minute that they asked him to add her to it. So he had to do it separately. And I'm not entirely sure what the process is exactly, but he said that he had to, it had to be mechanically added to the painting. But there was no way of knowing that it wasn't part of the original painting for it.
Hmm. He might, at that time, he might have painted it on like celluloid. Like the way that cartoons used to be made, like with a transparency.
That's what I was wondering. And then just kind of just left out gaps where Doc's leg would be obscured and stuff.
Yeah,
like
that. That's more than likely how they would have had to do it. Yeah. And then probably photographed it
from that point. Definitely worth checking out his account. It's just at Drew Struzan on Twitter. And he's sharing all this kind of artwork, which is really, really cool.
I'm really glad that I went back and watched these. It was a lot of fun. I love the music from part three. I love the feeling from part three. They do kind of ham-fist the ending. That's the only one little bit that I think was not quite as...
How so?
Sentimental. Well, so everything's fine. When they get back to 1985 and, you know, Marty does the smart thing. He doesn't race needles and he doesn't hit the Rolls Royce and like everything's fine. But I find that the acting from Jennifer is wooden, and they go back to the scene of the DeLorean crash where the train destroyed it. And then, of course, Doc shows up in the time-traveling steam engine, which is, it's cool. But there's just something so, like, we already kind of saw that Doc had a happy ending when he kind of flew off into the distance on the hoverboard with Clara.
Hmm.
You kind of knew that they were fine. They didn't go over the edge. Everything was good. I don't necessarily think I needed to see that sort of weird thing. The fact that Doc doesn't even get off the train, like he doesn't give Marty a hug. Like there's something really odd about how much they show that Marty and Doc care for one another. And then how cold the ending sort of feels. It does sort of feel tagged on to me.
Just kind of and fleeting kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, it still has that cool ending where it is neat that the train flies and it shoots into the screen and says the end and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, I get it. But I kind of thought, I was thinking like, okay, well, if you didn't like it, Joel, how would you have ended it? And I think you can do kind of two things. You can show that Doc had a happy ending, and you can maybe underlie the missing romance that you're not feeling with Jennifer and Marty. If you showed some sort of like, you know, Marty being sad, some sort of scene that depicts, you know, Marty really missing Doc, but then have Jennifer give Marty a gift and have it be that she's gone to the library and she's looked up, you know, what happened to like Doc Emmett Brown, you know, in the 1880s, and come back with like family photos of Doc and Clara and their kids. And like, I feel like that would still give the audience the same, oh, sweet, he had his happy ending. You like show a picture, because you could then have like a family photos, you know, like a photo album of like, you know, Doc's wedding, or, you know, like what he went on to do, you know, all that kind of stuff. Like, I think you could have a little bit of a thing there. Now, I mean, it's a small nitpick. It's not really, it's not really the biggest thing, but it just kind of struck me as like really kind of forced. Everything kind of happens in this one 2 minute scene.
I feel that they were trying to do the same as they did in the first one, that, you know, it kind of, the pace kind of goes down a bit. So they wanted to just bump it back up, you know, the excitement. So that you're ending on this exciting kind of thing. You know, it's like, you know, so where are you heading now? The future is like already been there. And my headcanon for fixing part of the issue that you described in terms of how he is with Marty is that this probably isn't the first time he's seen Marty since he's left 1885. Because we know he's gone to the future, we know he's gotten the hover conversion technology for the train. It could be that he's actually bumped into Marty there and they've actually had that bonding moment. So for him, it is kind of like a fleeting thing. And it's like, I'm heading off, but I'll be back and we'll hang out again. You know, so I think that's kind of where it is. Plus it also...
I think the problem is that for the audience, it's goodbye. If it's not goodbye for Doc and Marty, but for the audience, it's goodbye. You're like, oh, this sucks.
he's just gallivanting off. It did, however, allow them to make the cartoon series, which if he was stuck in 1885... would have meant that the cartoon wouldn't have been a possibility.
Right. I didn't even know
the cartoon. Yeah, there's an animated series and it mostly follows, like, it's Doc and Clara with their sons Jules and Vern, and so it's focusing more on them as a family, and Marty just pops around from time to time.
Oh, okay.
So you're not following Marty as like the lead character, that it's now Jules and Vern instead. And they had Christopher Lloyd star at the beginning in live action sequences talking about different science experiments, and Bill Nye was actually performing the science experiments, and I believe it was actually his first time in television doing that kind of stuff before he started presenting himself.
Wow.
But then Christopher Lloyd only did those segments. He didn't voice the character in the actual animated series. I can't remember who it was who did his voice, but and they constantly, like, you talk about you know, the meeting Buford Tannen and him being a bit of a Thingy Sam kind of character, and in the cartoon series, basically every time period they go to, there's a member of the Tannen family, and it's just parody after parody for it. I mean, it's designed for young kids. So. But and it's very much a 90s cartoon as well in that regard. So
I would have aged out of that, I think, by that point.
For kids now, getting into it, I think it's probably still quite fun. I like it because I watched it at the time it was airing.
Right.
So I have a bit of a nostalgic feel. But I think if you're an adult and you've grown up with the movies and you've never seen the animated series, you're probably not going to enjoy it so much going into the animation, because you're just going to be like, this is just not the same at all.
No.
So they've rebuilt the DeLorean as well. Doc built another DeLorean time machine, so they've got the DeLorean and the train. And so sometimes you have Marty having to go rescue Doc, or, you know, Doc's going to have to rescue Jules and Vern, and that happens quite a lot.
I know I've mentioned it on the show before. I haven't seen it in a long time, but somewhere around in Dartmouth, there is someone that owns a DeLorean. And in the summertime, they'll often be driving it around. Sometimes you'll see it parked at the local Tim Hortons. And it's...
I've heard.
You cannot walk by it without an immediate pang of just like, whoa, it's a DeLorean. Oh my God. It's just such a distinct car because of this film.
I've seen and touched, even though never supposed to. I broke rules with my mother's consent, because I was certainly an age where it's like, if there's a rule and a sign that says don't do something, I don't do it. And my mother's like, go on, touch it, otherwise you'll regret not doing it. I'm like, the sign says, and she's like, touch it. So I did. But I have touched the screen used DeLorean from Back to the Future 3, and it was specifically a stunt one. So it's not the hero one. So it didn't have all the gubbins inside. They have since added some of the gubbins inside, so like the flux capacitor and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it's specifically the car that they used when it's being pulled by all the horses and Doc and Marty are sat on top of the roof.
Right.
Just as they're trying to see, can they actually get up to 88 miles an hour? for on horsepower. But yeah, so I've seen that physical one in person, and that it looked really cool because obviously it's got the little box on top with all the little components that they've
the 1955 like circuit board that's the size of a chalkboard.
Yeah, that's it. It's just on the bonnet of the car, or the hood, as you would put it.
Yeah,
it's really, really cool. But yeah, I love DeLoreans, and I think anybody who grew up loving the movies, just I think it's just all part and parcel that you can't not love the style of a DeLorean. And yeah,
it's too bad they're just such an impractical car, you know?
Yeah. There's somebody who recently put up a video. I say recently, it may have been like in the last couple of years. But they had their own DeLorean. They had a dud DeLorean that they found from a skip. And they tested on the dud one to make sure they could do it. And then they've converted their DeLorean into a four-seater. So you've got the front seats, because it's normally a sports car, so you've only got the front two seats, and there's no seating in the back, because that was designed for golf clubs. But they've managed to actually get enough seating, so he can fit his family in, because he's like, I've got the kids now, I don't want to have to give up the DeLorean. So he modified his DeLorean so his kids can sit in the back. It's like, so good. I wish I was good enough. Like, he was like, it's simple, you just do this, you do that, and it's like, yeah, I don't have that experience. You know, but I would love to be able to do something like that if I was ever in that situation.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of the Citadel Cafe. I hope you've enjoyed our trip down memory lane to talk about the Back to the Future trilogy. If you'd like to find out more about the show, links to the things that we talked about in this episode, you can go to thecitadelcafe.com. The music for the show was also composed by Kevin MacLeod. You can email the show at thecitadelcafe@gmail.com and find us by name on Twitter and Facebook. Subscribe on iTunes, Android, Stitcher, and Spotify. A little bit of a note here. If you're wondering why I can't find the Citadel Cafe on Android or Google Play music, then it's gone to the Google Podcast app. It's been migrated. So look for it there if you're lost. Word of mouth is the easiest way to support the show. It's 100% free. You just poke a friend in the arm and say, hey, you should listen to this. They talked about Back to the Future and it was fun. I hope you had a good time. You would be surprised how far that goes. There are something crazy like 700,000 podcasts out there, even more so with the current pandemic pushing a lot of people to start their own podcasts. But we've been at this a while. So hopefully you're enjoying it and you'd like to share it with friends, because new listeners is always a good thing for the podcast. My name is Joel Duggan. You can find everything I am doing online at joelduggan.com. You can listen to my other podcast about Minecraft at thespawnchunks.com. I've been playing Minecraft Dungeons, which came out last week, on my Twitch channel, and we're going to be talking about that at length on this episode of The Spawn Chunks coming up on Monday. It's going to be a lot of fun. That's about it for me. It's all social media. My name, easy to find, Joel Duggan, and I will, of course, port you towards twitch.tv/Joel Duggan for some fun streams. Alistair, where can people find you and all the fun stuff you're doing online?
So I'm on Twitter as @imcfly. You can also find me on Twitch as Alistair McFly. That's A-L-A. I've got a website called ohmyzod.com, where I recently added a new retrospective on the spiritual sequel to Pinocchio, which was Pinocchio and the Emperor of the Night, starring James Earl Jones as the devil. So,
wow.
Really good stuff.
I did not know that existed.
Oh, yes, it does. Yeah, animated. It's a much darker film, but it's a spiritual sequel to it. But it's pretty neat. So, yeah, so you can read that over at ohmyzod.com as well.
You've been listening to The Citadel Cafe, where we are fast, easy, and cheap. It's heavy.